This is session 28 of Practical Ministry Skills. We're talking about working with leaders. This is from chapter 16 of the Pastoring the Nuts and Bolts book. Our key verse is, "Then the Lord said to me, write my answer plainly on tablets, so that a runner can carry the correct message to others." Habakkuk 2:2. And that's mainly talking about communication there. Last time we talked about finding leaders. Today we're talking about working with leaders. And communication may be the most important part of working with leaders. So write it plainly, so a runner can carry the correct message to others. God was concerned about the communication of His Word to His people. Communication has what I call the three C's of communication. Your communication has to be clear, it has to be complete, it has to be concise. It has to be clear. People need to understand what it is that you are trying to get across to them, what you want them to know. So ask yourself if there's any way that what you have written, what you plan to say, could be misunderstood. Because, as I've said before, generally, if something can possibly be read the wrong way, somebody will read it that wrong way. And they'll blame you for, because they'll say, "But that's what you wrote." And it doesn't help to say, "But that's not what I meant." There has to be no question. Make it clear as you possibly can. Make it complete. Ask yourself if you included all the necessary information. And be concise. Take out anything that's not necessary. Unnecessary words, irrelevant remarks, anything that can muddy the waters. Clear, complete, concise. Follow those rules when you're communicating with your leaders. Follow those rules when you're communicating with the congregation. Train your leaders to follow those rules when they're communicating with you and with each other, and especially with the congregation. And this is the kind of thing that's going to help them in every area of their lives anyway. If they everybody is called on all the time to communicate with other people. So just imagine how much nicer your whole community will be if people started communicating clearly and completely and concisely. One of the rules that I think that is important in working with leaders is to let them know that you will not allow blindsiding. Now, what is blindsiding? If you are an American football fan, then you probably know what blindsiding is. If not, let me explain that American football, there are the two teams, and the one team tries to knock down the guy on the other team that has the ball. And so there are generally, the play starts with the quarterback getting the ball, and if he's not handing it off to somebody else immediately to run, he's looking to throw it to somebody. And while he is looking, he's seeing in one direction, but he can't see what's behind him. That's his blind side. And so typically the left guard is there to protect the blind side. But if that player gets messed up or gets tripped up or the other opposing team gets around him, then the quarterback is looking down here and he has no idea, and all of a sudden, bang, the person from the other team slams into him and knocks him down, and he had no idea it was coming. Came right out of the blue without any kind of warning. That's called blindsiding. Don't let your people do that to you. It can happen. It can happen, and they won't intentionally do it, but if they are aware of something and you're not aware of it, then it can blow up in your face. It can blindside you. It can knock you down without you ever seeing it coming. So train your people first to recognize anything that might be that. If pastor didn't know about this and it happened, would that be a blindside? Let them ask themselves that. And let them know that you would rather be told about something twice than not told about it at all. Because if you're told twice, you can just say, thank you very much, I appreciate that. But if you're not told, then you can get blindsided and just knocked right down. So, no blindsiding. Centralized scheduling. This is an important thing, and the bigger your church gets, the more important it is. But you don't ever want to be in a situation that I was in one time where we had a specific event scheduled for the church building, and there was somebody else in an outside group that used the church all the time and scheduled something else for the same space in the same building at the same time, and thought that they had done it fine because we had a calendar posted, and this person came in and didn't see something there and wrote it on there and thought that by doing that she had appropriately scheduled this. But that's not the way that we did it. That calendar out front was just for general information and was not kept updated the way it should. And something else had already prior been scheduled for that time that couldn't be changed. And this outside group, this person got very upset. And it was just a very embarrassing situation for the whole church. So make sure everybody understands there is one person in charge of scheduling things. And make sure everybody knows who it is and how you go about scheduling things and what the rules are for scheduling things. In your communication, make sure that all the necessary information is there. Say who and what and when and where and why and how. Now, you don't necessarily need all of those, but you may recognize those as the questions that journalists are trained to answer in news articles. And your communications need to include all that information too. Say who and what and when and where and why and how. I have been very frustrated sometimes in trying to go to something that I was very interested in, but I couldn't figure out when it was. As a matter of fact, I remember one time after we retired and moved to Missouri and were looking for a church to attend, and we wanted to attend a certain particular church. We'd heard some things about it, and we could not find anywhere what time their service started. We knew where it was, but we looked online. We even drove by and looked on the sign. It never said what time the service was. And so we couldn't go. It took us an awful long time to find that out. So make sure it says everything that is needed. Acknowledge communications. It is very frustrating to send somebody an email and not know whether they got it. Send somebody a message on social media, or leave a message on the telephone, or send somebody over and say, go tell so-and-so, send one of your children over, go tell neighbor so-and-so this. And you never know whether they got the message or whether they understood it. So train your people to acknowledge communications, even if the communication asks a question and they don't have the answer yet. The tendency is to say, well, I'll answer that. I'll find out the answer and then get back with them. But finding out the answer might take 2 weeks. And in the meantime, the other person is saying, are they even working on this? Did they even ever hear about this? So when you get a message, say, I got this, I'm working on it, I'll get back to you. And that way at least you know that your message was received. Now, I have to acknowledge I'm not very good at this, but it's something I'm trying to work on. And it's important for you to acknowledge communications from other people and to train your people to acknowledge communications from you. In your communications, reinforce the vision. Reinforce the vision. Wherever you can, wherever it's appropriate, if there is something that you're moving towards, include that, some reference to it in your communications. It may be that if you have a concise vision statement and you communicate by emails, have that vision statement as part of the automatic signature to your emails so that everybody that gets an email from you reads that again and has it reinforced. But take every opportunity to reinforce the vision. Over-communicate. Over-communicate. It is amazing how people can ignore messages, communications. I've had people come to me, and you may well also, "Oh, Pastor, how come I didn't know about this?" And the answer is, well, I don't know. It was announced in church for 3 weeks, and we put it in the bulletin for 3 weeks, and we put it in the newsletter, and it was on the Facebook page, and I don't know why you didn't know about it. And then sometimes they'll say, "Yeah, but how come nobody told me?" You know, unless somebody specifically comes and buttonholes them and says, "Hey, this is specifically for you," they ignore all the rest of that stuff. I even saw a T-shirt advertised for pastors, and it said, "It was in the bulletin 3 weeks." In your communications, in all of your ministry, but especially in communications, be careful about confidential information. Don't put out in public confidential information. Don't put anything online that tells the addresses, the home address of your people who are homesick. Because that's just an invitation to a burglar. They get online, they say, "Oh, there's a sick person all by themselves at this house." Or when you're going on vacation. But not just that kind of thing. People will tell you things in counseling that is confidential, that they would be very embarrassed if anybody else knew. Be very, very careful not to let any of that out, not to hint at it, not to use it as a sermon illustration, even if you say, I can't tell you who this is. Because somebody's going to guess, and even if they don't, the person's still going to feel betrayed. Be careful about confidential information. So how do you work with leaders and workers beyond the communication? Everybody has a natural leadership style. But every situation can respond better to different kinds of leadership styles, and every person can respond better to different kinds of leadership styles. So learn what your natural leadership style is, but then also learn to adjust your natural leadership style to the person and to the situation. So adjust your style. Spend time with your leaders. Spend time with them. Get to know them. Let them get to know you. These are volunteers. You're not paying these people, presumably, to do what you tell them to do. So build that relationship. It's all based on that relationship. They want to serve God in the church, yes, but build that relationship. Spend time with them. The more you get to know them, the more you know what you can ask them to do and what you'd better not ask them to do, what they probably just might not be capable of. Encourage them, especially if they mess something up. If they're new in a position and they don't get something right, they make a mistake, don't come down on them. You might have to correct them and show them how to do it right, but encourage them. Encourage them. train your people. And I think we went over this before briefly, but the four steps of training are, I do it, you watch me. I do it, you help me. You do it, I help you. You do it, I watch you. Once you reach that fourth step, if the person is doing it right, they're trained and you can leave them to do it and you can go do something else. Resource your leaders. Give them whatever it is that they need to do their job. Don't count on them to provide it out of their own resources. They may not even know what they need, and they may not be able to afford it or know how to get it. You provide for them what they need to get the job done. Protect your leaders, because there are going to be people in your church, because there are human beings in your church, so I can say this with confidence, there will be people in your church who will find fault. They won't like the way that somebody has done something. They don't like the way this person is leading this committee or the decision they made about that. You protect your leaders. Let them know that you've got their back. You're going to support them. Give your leaders feedback. Tell them how they're doing, especially if they're new in the job. They want to know if they're doing right. You need to build up their confidence. They need to know that you'll be there for them. Give them feedback. If they're doing wrong, they'll want to know that too. If they're teachable, and if they're not teachable, you shouldn't have asked them to be a leader. So give them feedback, positive and negative. More positive if you possibly can. And in giving negative feedback, there's an old, very commonly used technique called the a sandwich, where you, I think it may be called a praise sandwich, where you start with something good, then you slide in the correction. By the way, you know, this, I noticed that you might want to try doing this other thing, this other way next time. But then end with another positive thing, another praise thing. So you're starting and ending on the good note and sandwiching the correction in between. Celebrate them when they do well. Celebrate them not only with private encouragement, but celebrate them publicly. If your church has something that somebody else put on, some program, and it worked out well, then the next service, thank that person publicly for making it go so well. Celebrate your leaders. They again, they're volunteers. They don't have to be doing this stuff. When necessary, you might have to replace a leader. And that's a difficult thing. If you have term limits built into your positions, that can be kind of an easy way to ease somebody out. Just, well, you were elected for a three-year term, and now it's the end of 3 years, and so thank you for your service. And according to our policy, we have to get somebody else. There are pros and cons to term limits, and I think I cover them in the book. But sometimes you're just going to have to replace somebody because either they turn out to not be able to do the job, or something has come up in their life that takes a lot of time that they didn't have to do that when you asked them to take the job, and now they can't devote their time to it. In a situation like that, if it's a time situation or a personal issue in their family or something that's taking their focus away, they may actually be grateful that you are offering them the chance to step down and you're going to find somebody else to do it. They may have felt obligated to do it and not want to come ask you to relieve them from the obligation, but they may appreciate it. But even if they don't want to quit, if they are causing damage, if they're causing harm, either by doing something wrong or by just morally wrong, that is, or just by being totally incompetent or neglecting the duty, whatever it is, if you have to replace them, replace them. Don't do that all by yourself as the pastor or the ministry leader. Have make it a group decision. So otherwise, the person's friends will all come down on you. But if it's a group decision and it can be shown to be according to the policies and everything, that really protects you a lot. But don't be afraid to replace somebody if they need to. Never let one person or group hold the church hostage. And we talked about that in terms of if they're a big donor giving a lot of money, if they have a lot of influence, but also if they're doing an important job. You can find somebody else. God will find somebody else. God wants your church to succeed, and God has the people in mind that He will raise up to take care of it. When leaders do wrong, in the book I covered this mainly in chapter 18, but 1 Timothy 5:19 says, "Do not listen to an accusation against an elder unless it's confirmed by two or three witnesses." Never just let one person who might just have a bone to pick with somebody else come and complain. Make sure there are at least two or three people who are willing to stand up. If somebody is doing wrong, though, the ultimate goal is not that they be punished. The ultimate goal is that they'll be restored to the Lord. And we're talking here specifically if it's not so much a neglect or an incompetence thing, but a sin situation. The ultimate goal is that they'll be restored to the Lord. And if possible, to any people who were harmed, and that the church and everybody involved will be stronger for the experience. Now, as minister, it is your responsibility to protect the church. Not the church as an institution necessarily, but all the other people that could be harmed by the actions of this one person that did wrong. It's best, as I've said before, to have a policy in place ahead of time so that your decisions about how you handle something are not colored by personalities and relationships. Jesus tells a real good policy, as a matter of fact, in Matthew 18. Oh, there we go. "If another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense." Now, that if they commit a sin that brings disgrace on the church, that is also covered here in sinning against you. Go privately. Point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses, you've won that person back. That's all you have to do. But if you're unsuccessful, in other words, if they won't listen to you, they won't acknowledge it, they defend themselves, but you're still pretty certain that this is a case, take one or two others with you and go back again so that everything you say may be confirmed by two or three witnesses. So they'll see it too. They'll be able to look. And it may be that the person may listen. Now that there's three of you, they may say, "Well, the jig is up, I can't deny it anymore." Or they may come around and acknowledge and repent. If the person still refuses to listen, Jesus says, take your case to the church. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean preach a sermon about it. It probably absolutely does not mean preach a sermon about it. But it doesn't necessarily mean take it to the whole church. It means take it to the appropriate decision-making body in your church, the board of elders, the presbytery, the deacons, the whoever it might be. Then, if he or she won't accept the church's decision, treat that person as a pagan or a corrupt tax collector. Now, that doesn't mean shun them and denounce them as horrible people. It just means treat them like they're not Christians yet and treat them like you would any other non-Christian. Now, there are certain accusations where you would have to remove the person immediately before you go through this whole process. If it has to do with stealing money and it's the person that handles the money, you need to get them out of the position where they can steal any more money. while you're working through all the process. If it has to do with accusations of abuse of some kind, you have to remove them from the place where they have, where they're around those kind of people that they might abuse, while you work through the process. But the point of all of it, ideally, is restoration. You want the person restored. You want the person to come to repentance, to acknowledge that they did wrong, and to turn around and move in the right direction, move back to God. But you cannot afford to just accept their word for it. Oh, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. There needs to be some kind of proof of change. Through accountability, set up some kind of, you should have some kind of accountability process where the person works through and they're holding themselves accountable to somebody that can see whether or not what they say about changing their mind and not wanting to do it again really seems to be true in their life. Make the decision to restore should be a decision of the same group that decided to remove them. And then you don't restore everything all at once. You gradually add responsibilities and evaluate and say, have they really repented and turned a new leaf? But don't make that last forever. There should be a specific ending point with a celebration of welcoming them back. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians about how he wanted the church at Corinth to deal with a certain specific sinner. But in 2 Corinthians, he went back to this person, the topic of this person, in writing his letter and said, now, however, it is time to forgive and comfort him. Otherwise, he may be overcome by discouragement. So I urge you now to reaffirm your love for him. See, if somebody knows they've done wrong and is forced to face that and forced to go through a process of restoration, then they're going to feel pretty bad about themselves. They're going to feel like this is not a good situation. If they come to believe that no matter what they do, they will never be welcomed back, that is extremely discouraging and can drive them away not only from the church but from God. So there needs to be a time where once you realize that they really have proven their repentance to your satisfaction, welcome them back and encourage other people. Now, sometimes when you have to confront somebody, they will accept it with grace and appreciation. Where Jesus said, if they listen to you, then that's fine, you've won them back. I had a Sunday school teacher at one church that I served that did something wrong. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a pretty bad thing. And so it came to me, and I went and I said, I've heard about this, and the person... I confessed and said yes, and I said, well, in light of that, I don't think it's appropriate for you to continue as a Sunday school teacher. And they said, well, you know what, I agree with you, and that actually takes a load off of my mind because I really want to focus on this process of restoration. But you need to be aware that, I mean, that was wonderful. That's the way it's supposed to go. But be aware that, and by the way, after a while that Sunday school teacher was returned to the position and served wonderfully. But be aware that some people will fight it and they will rally support from church friends against you. And I think I already told the story about the that happening to me. So sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Whatever you do, the whole thing, soak it in prayer and do it in love. And I'll see you next time.